Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this DB class. So my name is Eddie and I'm one of the tutors here, and I'll be leading you through this class called Presenting the Path. So we're studying the Dharma, and it's important to be relaxed and alert. So adjust your posture in your seat so that you are sitting up straight. This means your shoulders are relaxed and your back is straight. Your chin is tucked in ever so slightly, and your eyes can be either half closed, half open. And you are breathing normally and naturally. And while you continue to breathe normally and naturally, I'd like you to become aware of the movements that take place either in your upper chest or your lower abdomen each time you inhale and exhale. And while you continue to breathe normally and naturally, imagine if the spiritual families of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas came from the 10 directions of space and appeared above your head. And while these enlightened beings are present in the space above you, think that every other sentient being is sitting, surrounding you. And every one of them is related to you as a parent, an uncle or aunt, brother, sister or child. And while you are in relationship with all these people, recollect that your happiness has always depended upon their kindness. And while they too wished to be happy and equally to avoid suffering, every one of them has never, ever been genuinely happy. Now that all the auspicious causes and conditions to awaken are present, form the resolve that you have not previously had to quickly attain, for the sake of all sentient beings, the state of enlightenment. And by doing so, turn their mind to the truth. Help them practice the truth as a path. Help them remove obstacles from the path. And inspire them to purify their confusion into wisdom. Their natural birthright, a state of unchanging goodness. And to accomplish this, we're going to take refuge in the families of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas above us and generate the mind of enlightenment. So we do this by taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. So if you'd like to just recite along with me, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Then to stabilize this wish and to enhance it, making it even greater, we recite the prayer of the Four Immeasurables. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Now, to attain enlightenment, we need to accumulate all the causes and conditions that bring that about, and similarly, purify the mind of everything that hinders enlightenment. The practices of accumulation and purification are summed up in a prayer called the Seven Limbs. So we'll recite that now. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Another great hindrance to bringing about our welfare and the welfare of everyone else is the clinging to our own body, our own self, our own ideas, our own goodness, our merit. So here we're going to let go of the clinging. In the absence of clinging, imagine a wonderful pure land appearing where all beings can take teachings from us as fully enlightened beings. And we're going to offer this up to the families of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in front of us. This is called the short mandala offering. So this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamnariyatayam. Now the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas above us smile at us in delight for making that offering. All the families of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas begin to dissolve into light, which is drawn into the central figure of Shakyamuni Buddha. Now he becomes very small in size and moves through space to abide above the crown of your head. He's facing the same way you are. He begins to descend through space, entering the crown of your head, going down further to arrive at your chest at the level of the heart, whereupon the light begins to expand, filling your body and mind with light. The light expands further, going out through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space. Wherever there are living beings within space, they are touched by that light and transformed, becoming fully awakened, enlightened beings. From the heart center of each of these beings, light again goes out into the 10 directions of space. So resting in the light, acknowledge your true nature, to be open, unbounded, and limitless. Think that the light begins to withdraw from the 10 directions of space and re-enters your body at the level of the heart. And you feel yourself embodied, sitting at your chair. And you're breathing normally and naturally. But there's also an awareness of the deeper nature of your mind. And you remind yourself that the mind has the potential to awaken completely, bringing about your own welfare and the welfare of others. And what you're going to do is to take the potential of that mind and make it happen. Bring about full enlightenment for yourself and for everyone else. And breathing normally and naturally, breathing deeply. Exhale. And bring your awareness back to the screen, and we'll begin the class. So here, as you can see, we're on to class 7. We have 2 more classes, next week's class, and then there'll be the review. And we've covered quite a lot of material. We look at the paths practiced in the 3 levels of an individual. So these paths can be seen as the paths of renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view. And the levels of the individual are those of, you know, the individual level, the small scope, the middling scope, and then the great scope. And the initial levels of practices were covered in verses 1 and 2, and the intermediate 3, 4, 5, and advanced levels in terms of practicing the mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta, were 6, 7, and 8. Now, altogether, we have covered 9 verses because last week we were introduced to the view. Now, all up, you know that in your reading material that you have, there are a couple of suggested public exam, which we're not actually doing. And there was also an assessment, and they had different questions on them. So I've answered just about all of the questions of both of those. And today's class will finish off with the last couple of questions. So we're still on this, what we call the advanced level of practitioner. So this person is developing the mind of enlightenment. And they do so by practicing the perfections. So we introduced the perfections last week, and we're going to just mention these last two. And we're going to finish off the text by going from verses 9 to 14. So these verses are really talking about what they call the view. So you know, the 3 principal aspects were renunciation, bodhicitta, and the view. So these 5 verses will be about that. Last week we identified the importance of the view and the reason for meditating on it. Once we know of its importance and its the reason for meditating on it, we need to sort of identify what that view is. And then once we've identified what it is, we can start becoming familiar with it through meditation. So these are some of the books that I've been relying upon. Now, the top five books are all in a series called The Library of Wisdom and Compassion. They have been written by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Venerable Thupten Chodron. And so I've pulled a lot of information from these books. And if you've never come across these books before or haven't read them, I can suggest them that you do and recommend them. They're terrific, well-written, easy to understand. Now, the three first books down the bottom here, they all have to do with, you know, the text where we've been talking about through the last 6 weeks, all focused on three principal aspects of the path. And the last two books really deal quite in depth with what we call the view. So the view is this insight into emptiness or insight into the ultimate nature of how things exist. So in these two books, especially as How to See Yourself as Really as You Really Are, is a fantastic book for beginners and an introduction to it, whereas Insight into Emptiness really gets into the nitty-gritty of it. However, it's very well written, once again, by Venerable Thupten Chodron. Now, we're going to start with the perfection, so let's look at the first one. So this is the perfection of meditative stability, also called the perfection of concentration. And this picture here with the elephant, the monk and so forth, is a sort of pictorial presentation of how concentration can be developed through nine stages until it becomes what they call a calmly abiding mind. And this is how meditative stability is defined as a mental factor that is capable of abiding one-pointedly on an object of virtue without distraction. So to develop and have an authentic mind of renunciation, a mind that, you know, really seeks to abandon all the causes of suffering and become free and liberated, meditative stability is required. And also an understanding of the view. And which leads us to this, the perfection of wisdom. It's described as a mental factor able to correctly discern the object of analysis. So wisdom is the ability to distinguish and deeply understand conventional and ultimate truths, and to discern or to know what to practice and what to abandon on the path. When this wisdom is conjoined with bodhicitta, then it becomes a perfection of wisdom.
And so Eddie, the object of analysis is the view, or?
Well, like I said, it could be a conventional truth or an ultimate truth. When we come to, where we're coming to, it's going to be the ultimate truth. But it could be either.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So to deeply understand conventional and ultimate truths. And by doing so, know what to practice and what to abandon. Today's presentation, the object of analysis is going to be the ultimate truth. So in the Sanskrit tradition, the perfection of wisdom is of three types. Wisdom understanding emptiness, that's the first. The second is wisdom of fields of knowledge and skills necessary to benefit sentient beings. That's the second. And third, wisdom knowing how to benefit sentient beings. But here, our wisdom, like I said, is realizing emptiness. Because without that realization, we remain stuck in samsara, and our ability to help others is very restricted. So we're going to now move into the verse 9, which talks about the importance of the view. So I know we did this last week, so we're not going to spend a great deal of time on it, but I just want to reintroduce to you the concepts. So here is the verse. It says, though familiar with renunciation and bodhicitta, You cannot cut the root of compulsive existence without wisdom realized in the ultimate nature. Therefore, use every means to realize dependent arising. So from this point on, the text, verse 9 to 14, it's really, the text is really explaining the nature of emptiness and the wisdom that realizes it. And this is of great importance, because without that realization, though you may have a mind that seeks freedom, a mind that wishes to bring about enlightenment for yourself and others, that can't be done unless you have wisdom realized in the ultimate nature. And the way to realize that is to come at it through means of dependent arising. This is the suggestion that Lama Tsongkhapa is making. So we have this term called dependent arising, and there are a number of different types of it, and there are also different names for it, like dependent arising, dependent establishment, dependent designation, and so forth. But the real clue is the word dependent. So again, you know, you probably remember some of this material, but we're just refreshing our minds about it. So now we're going to look at these levels of dependent arising. Here we've called it levels of dependent establishment. In other words, we're establishing dependent arising or dependency. And first is what they call arising through meeting. This refers to effects arising through causes, causal dependence. The second is existing in reliance. This means that all phenomena depend on their parts. Third, dependent existence. This refers to all phenomena existing by being merely designated, or meaning merely named, independence upon their basis of designation and the mind that conceives and designates them. So I know there's a whole lot of words here, you've probably never heard of them before, but it's okay. We're going to do a few more slides of this, and I'll say it a few more times and show it in different ways, and hope you can get it that way. Now, there's a school called the Middle Way Consequence School, and they are the most subtle and deepest ways of understanding dependent arising or dependent establishment. And they've just got a different way of setting out the same thing that I just told you about, these three points here. So here they call it causal dependence, the very first one, which is just the same as arising through meeting. Okay. Effects arise due to their own causes. Then we have this thing called a dependent designation, and it's got two parts. These being mutual dependence and mere dependent designation. So mutual dependence is talking about how something can be posited in relationship to something else. And if the something else is not there, then what it's related to also vanishes. So we have things like, simple one here, mutual dependence is here and there. Self and other. Past and present. So these, you'll find that, you know, these are terms dependent upon one another. They don't exist independently as they seem to. And last, we have mere dependent designation, which is similar to dependent existence, meaning something exists as a mere name or a mere designation. And in that verse that we showed just a minute ago, when they talked about, when Lama Tsongkhapa said, therefore use every means to realize dependent arising, his meaning is designation, which is called a subtle dependent arising. Because emptiness itself is a very, emptiness of inherent existence is a very subtle phenomena. So now we're going to look at these again in a couple of other ways. So let's have a look at the first one. I'll just call it interdependence one. So again, arising through meeting. Effects arise from causes. So this is the most common explanation of the meaning of dependent arising. And this is accepted by all the Buddhist traditions. Existing in reliance, all phenomena depend upon their parts. So this is very important from another school point of view called the mind-only school. So when effects arise from causes, we're talking about produced phenomena or things that are impermanent, that change. So those phenomena that are impermanent change depend for their existence through causes and conditions, and also their parts. But if the phenomena was not causal, if it existed but did not depend upon causes and conditions, it would still depend upon parts. And finally, this most subtle explanation of dependent arising, called dependent existence, that everything, all phenomena existing by being merely designated, meaning merely named, independence are upon their basis of designation, the parts, and the mind that conceives and designates them.
So Eddie, this, just the way that you said it, it's really struck me that that's what I've always heard was only half of the formula. So the formula is the label and the mind that puts the label.
Oh yeah, that's right.
So
yeah,
that's right. So funny, because I've always just heard merely labeled, as if it's like some independent phenomena without the person labeling.
yeah, that's right. You could hear that. But this really shows you that things, for their existence, depend upon the mind. It's the mind that plays a major role here. You know, without a mind involved in it, without consciousness, you can't even talk about objects. You know? So it's the mind that goes, well, you know, the object I'm dealing with, so it's, you know, it's already appearing to the mind, and then it names it, of course.
So that just takes us right back to the big discrepancy that we have with our Western background, where we still cling to this idea of an objective truth.
Yep, that's right. An objective truth and an objective reality. A reality that's independent of a mind. It doesn't need to depend upon a mind. That's right. Yeah. And Buddhism puts out that's impossible. And if you think about it, it is impossible. And that's what we've first got to get our head around. That's why it's saying get your head around interdependence first of all. And what I would suggest is you don't believe me just because I'm saying it, or you don't believe it just because it's on a slide, and you don't believe it just because you've read it, and you don't believe it because somebody called the Buddha said it, and Nagarjuna, all these people. That's all well and good. But you have to find out yourself. You have to determine, is that true? And the way to do that is very simple. Just go, oh, no, it's not like this at all. It's the opposite. Like phenomena do not depend upon their parts. So if you say that to me, I go, great, tell me a phenomenon. Give me a demonstration. Illustrate what you're saying to me. Give me something that exists that does not have parts. You know, so you find very quickly, geez, you don't know of anything like that. And it's the same with the other one. You know, find me an effect that doesn't, it's not supported with causes and conditions. So you just look around yourself, you see lots of effects around you, and go, well, you know, take that one there. Does that depend upon causes and conditions? You'll say, oh yeah, okay, not that one, not that one, not that one. So, well, keep looking. You know, try and find anything that's produced, anything that, you know, an effect And and then you could go, gee, I can't find any. And he said, well, the Buddha didn't find any either. That's why he said effects arise through causes and conditions. If it's a produced phenomena and a phenomena that changes, it means that that phenomena depended for its existence on causes and conditions. And those causes and conditions are subject to change and fluctuation. So you go, okay, it's true. Then you come to the next one. You're just going to find something that has no parts. What could that be? When you find you can't find anything at all, then you can say, okay, whatever exists does so depend upon parts. Last one. We're just going to find something that I could know without a mind. It's impossible. So you finally go, okay, I believe it. It's true.
And so even if it's not my mind that knows it, it's somebody else's mind that knows it.
Yeah, that's right. Whatever the thing is, it cannot remove mind from the picture and have things that are known to exist. Their knowledge of their existence depends on something to know it, which is a mind. So this is why sometimes you see in the text, the mind has always existed. It doesn't have a beginning. There was no time whatsoever when a mind did not exist. And of course, once that happens, then you have all the objects exist. But to go the other way and say, first of all, there's this objective world, and then it was all there, and then suddenly, we got to know it. Then mind came along and then knew it. It's, you have to go like, well, how did that happen? How do we even know that all these things were here without a mind engaging in it? Anyway, that's the first one. Let's look at interdependence too. So once again, causal dependence. Effects arise due to their own causes, and these causes have to be supported with conditions. So once again, we're talking about the impermanent phenomena, the produced phenomena. Second is this dependent designation. Remember these two parts, mutual dependence. Things that are positive relative to each other, here and there, close and far, cause and effect, you and I, rich and poor, big and small, all of these things. So mutual dependence. So something, like I said, mutual dependence, if you call something small, it can only be small in relationship to something else. Same with big, same with rich, poor, you, I.
And loud and soft as well.
Yep, that's right. There's so many of them, Yet often when we use those words, we forget that what we're describing is dependent upon something that is not that. But without that other thing, what we're talking about here. And lastly, we have this, mere dependent designation. So when we talk about mere dependent designation, we're talking about conventional truth, things existing conventionally, and conventionalities. Like all these things, you and I, that's a conventionality, rich and poor, conventional, big and small, all conventional, effects conventional, causes conventional. They're all aspects of the conventional truth. They are conventions that exist through name and the mind. Now, this word mere is really important. It's saying that things exist nominally by name and mind. And that when you, and how have we come to that conclusion is the question, really. We investigate to see the phenomena, if they exist as more than names or designations. But when you do that, the objects sort of disappear, vanish. You don't find those objects. They can't be found. Yet not finding them does not mean they are non-existent. It just means they don't exist objectively. Because why? Because we can't find them objectively. They don't have that type of existence. So they're not non-existent. They just don't exist objectively.
It's very slippery, Eddie. It's like shifting sands.
It is. That's right. That's right. And yeah, like that's what will happen to your mind. It, like, your mind sort of goes a little bit wobbly. And the way to sort of to make this understanding a bit more stable is to first, like I said, take the opposite view of interdependence, which we're going to come to, right? Just analyze, look at the phenomena that are appearing in front of you and ask yourself, like, how do they seem to exist? And the first answer you come up with is objectively. That's a thing existing in and of itself over there. That's an object. And I'm over here. Right, so no mutual dependence and no causal dependence. Right, so then we investigate. We take that phenomenon and go, okay, so what's that thing called I'm looking at? Oh, that's a book. Okay, so if the book objectively exists, when I searched amongst all of its parts, there should be a book there. What I'm looking at, there should be a book there. Right, because that's what it's looking like to me. And then we call that true existence. The object appears to exist in the way I'm apprehending it. If it did exist in the way that I'm apprehending it, has been actually there, then it'd have true existence, or existence from its own side. It's over there. Of course, when we analyze, we don't find it there at all. You know, so it's not there objectively. It doesn't have objective existence. This does not mean it does not exist at all. It means that the way we thought it existed and the way it's appearing, we're wrong. That's all it means. But now we have to say, well, how does it exist? That analysis of into the objective existence of things, we find, doesn't exist like that. So we find lots of things that don't exist in the way we first thought. Our question will arise, well, then how do they exist? This is all very interesting, but I still don't know how it exists. So in mere name, with the mind involved. And it can only be that way. That's the great thing. You know, once you've gone over and over looking for the objective existence in things, looking for something that is independent of us, not interdependent, but independent, not dependent upon us. We look at those objects, they don't have that type of existence. They don't exist like that. So it's not that they're non-existent, they do exist, but not like that. So then we come back as existing in mere name or mere designation.
Anne is saying it's almost like we have a circular argument that we think we've arrived at a conclusion, but then we're at the beginning again, you know, so right. It appears one way, we go looking for it, thinking it's got to be here somewhere, not there, but yet it's but here.
Yeah,
that's
right. Yeah, it exists.
But yet it exists.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So this term, you know, mere name. So it doesn't mean that things are just words or sounds. You know, but that's not the case, is it? It means they exist by being merely designated. The fact that things exist dependent on being merely designated does not mean that whatever our mind thinks up is real, or that whenever we're designating something with a term, it becomes that object. Because that's another thing where your mind can slip off. You go, shit, I'm just making it all up. Well, you are making up a great deal of it, but not all of it.
So that is really then like the experience of the middle way that it's not going over to, oh, therefore nothing exists, because clearly that's I'm right. Here having this thought, and yep. It's not going over to it really, really exists.
That's right, because I had a look for the real existence and it's not there. That's right.
So Anne is asking, is it that a thing exists in mere name because we've given it that name, for instance, the book, and then say when we die, then it won't exist, the book won't exist anymore?
The book will not exist for us, but it'll exist for plenty of other people who've called it a book.
Yep, okay. And then Anthea is asking, so it kind of takes the edge off our black and white kind of perceptions, for instance, the idea of failure. So there is no fail. You've just discovered what to do or what something is not. You know, it's a process.
That's right. That's right. So then we can see, the meaning of failure is dependent.
So that really shows how this view can start liberating us from suffering immediately, because with this example of failure, how many people are terrified of failure?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And those who aren't make the greatest advances, aren't they? Because for them, it's, just like Anthea said, failure is just finding out something that didn't work. That's great. I can keep working. So this is really sort of showing us how important the view is. And what it really does, just like you said, it really shakes things up. And it stops you sort of clinging so tightly with your mind to your ideas of things being this or that.
Which would be very helpful in terms of identity as well, nationalism and gender identity and status anxiety, all of those things.
All of those things, yeah.
Free us from.
Yeah. And, those things, if you really look at them, they're just names put onto events or something else, So let's have, this verse 9. It's talking about the importance of the understanding of the view, but the way to come at it is through dependent arising, through interdependence. Because if you see that things exist interdependently, then they cannot exist objectively. They cannot exist independently, because these two things go against one another. If it's dependent, it's not independent. It's not not dependent. If it's interdependent, it means it relies on other things. So it can't have an objective existence. It can't have an intrinsic existence. It can't have an existence where there are no dependencies involved at all. So this really, so therefore, once you get that, you go, my God, suffering can be overcome. Whatever exists, it's all dependent. There's nothing existing in and of itself. It looks like it is that way. It feels as if it's that way. But it's not that way. So everything becomes malleable. Everything becomes sort of usable and sort of friendly in a way. Because whatever you bring to something, it's going to affect that something. Because nothing is, like I said, completely independent and objective and separated off from one another. So let's go on to verse 10. And this is really talks about this, the meaning, what we need to understand with this view, that things exist interdependently. So here we have this first type, cause and effect, right? When you see that for all phenomena in samsara and beyond, in nirvana, cause and effect is unfailing. And the object of fixation perishes. So the object of fixation, they're referring here to objective existence, intrinsic existence, things that exist truly. So all those ideas fall by the wayside. They perish. But cause and effect rolls on. Just because things lack objective existence does not mean to say cause and effect is out the window. It doesn't matter anymore. In fact, it matters even more if you think about it. He says, so once you get this idea, this is when you've entered a path that pleases the victors. So if you can, if we can clearly ascertain and assert the infallibility of dependent arising, and if without doing harm to this understanding of dependent arising, we can destroy the perception that things exist inherently or objectively or independently, then you've entered the path that pleases the Buddhas. So the first two lines introduce the assertion that if we could understand cause and effect within and beyond cyclic existence as infallible and composite the existence and function of cause and effect rather than its non-existence, then we can eliminate the extreme of nihilism. So what happens for us usually when we get introduced to this material, if you start to investigate the appearance that objects have to objectively exist or to exist independently of our consciousness, what will happen, of course, is you those objects disappear. You can't find any such object that exists like that. What usually happens is the mind quickly goes towards non-existence. They don't exist at all, because I had a real good look for them and they're not there. So this happened to me when I was about 18. And I had no idea of Buddhist teachings or anything like that. I just did this analysis. And when I couldn't find them, like, it was a big shock. I thought then they don't exist. And then in terms of my behavior, it became quite nihilistic in terms of my beliefs. I didn't believe anything after that. And that was going like too far, you know. I'd drawn a wrong conclusion. But that's just what happens when all the things you thought were true and really there, you find they're not there like that. They disappear when you subject them to analysis.
So, Eddie, also, Anthea has brought up a interesting point that then we are like a condition or a trigger in a way to other people's experience.
Of course.
As well. And so then it's really important that we watch, you know, what we give, what we do, what we say, that actually that means we have a whole lot of power also at the moment, say, to contribute to world peace at a grassroots level right now, because we are that condition.
That's right. That's dead right.
Anne also says it does feel like a slippery slope towards nihilism, and it's at that point that where her mind struggles.
So they often say that this view of the middle way is like walking on a knife edge. You know, it could slip off on the way. It's very... So that's why you sort of got to do like one thing at a time. You know? And like one of the things that didn't sort of save me, but it made me not be completely nihilistic, was the thing that even thinking all the stuff, I could still say, but I'm thinking it all. So I'm obviously here, I obviously exist, but that's when I went to do the analysis, like I don't exist. So it's really did my head in for many years, you know.
It just makes me feel like a drunken philosopher, you know, lurching from one side to the other.
Yeah. So I'll introduce you now to an analogy. And this is what they call the analogy of the thief is called, right? So here we have a picture of a thief. Now, the thing about this picture is that we know what the thief looks like. You know, we can see, oh, he's got sort of dark clothing on. He's got a beanie and a mask. Looks sort of elderly. And he's carrying a big bag with a swag on his shoulder. That's what the thief looks like. So if we see this bloke around the house or in town or anything like that, we know that's the thief. Because we know what he looks like. Now, if we don't know what he looks like and we say, yeah, the house has been burgled, and the police say, did you see the thief? And we go, no, don't know what he looks like. Then there's really no way to catch that thief, is there? Catching the thief really depends upon us knowing what the thief looks like. Now, if we want to find the ultimate truth of any object, the emptiness of the object, we have to catch something before we can discover its emptiness. And what we have to catch is a thing called inherent existence. So that means we have to know what inherent existence is. And so just like we need to know a thief before we can catch him, we need to be able to identify what is this thing called inherent existence, which I'm being told is the root of all of my suffering. What's that look like? And so this is what this analogy is about. So inherent existence is what we call the object of negation. And the thing of the object of negation is like, that's what is not true. So a negation is a not, it's a negative. So inherent existence appears to us to be true. We're examining, we know all about it, and it appears to us to be true. We're going to negate that truth. We're going to ask and see, is it really true? And then find it's not. So we don't believe in it anymore. Now, this thing called inherent existence, it does not, in fact, exist, but it appears to. So remember here, other words for inherent existence are existing by its own nature, objective existence, natural existence, independent existence. These are all the same, different words, but they're all getting at the same thing. Another term they use is existing from its own side. These are all the objects of negation, because nothing actually exists like that. But it looks like that. It looks like that. We investigate to see if it is like that. And then we negate the, not the appearance, but the fact that it's true. So, for example, if you have a friend and they appear in front of you, it will immediately appear to your senses that there is my friend, that I see my friend like over there, that my friend's over there. And we would say that, and conventionally, that's true. But if we want to see if is that really true, is it my friend like really there, then where are we going to look for the friend, folks?
Well, in the body.
Yeah, over there, aren't we? In that over body. There? I mean, we have our friend, there's their body. Either my friend is their body, or he's in the body. He's over there. He's not over here, he's over there. Now, so that when you, so that's what we call inherent existence, objective existence, existing from the side of the object. The object from the side is the body and mind. My friend is like over there, it's on that side, not my side, that side. So that's like I was saying, identifying the thief. We're identifying objective existence, inherent existence. So that's what we do with external objects. When you do it with yourself, you need something to either shock you or surprise you, so that yourself appears quite vividly to your own awareness. And you go, oh, there I am. That's the appearance of me.
So it is that to get like a strong feeling of me.
It's to identify inherent existence.
Okay.
And in this case, it's the inherent existence of me, of my own I, my own identity. So we have an identity, we have an I, but what I said, we need it to appear to us inherently, because that's how we're always holding it. We're always thinking we exist like that, just like we think our friend is over there. It looks like he's over there. We think they are. Right? So that, what's important here is to first get the appearance of inherent existence.
So that we can identify it, because otherwise it's just kind of there as a baseline. We're not aware of it.
Yeah. So here, this is Jumpa Tegchok. He says, since the object of negation, inherent existence, does not in fact exist, cannot be ascertained, because ascertainment implies a valid mind for realizing an object that exists. So what then does ascertaining the object of negation actually mean? It means gaining certainty about the way in which the object of negation would exist if it did exist. Would exist if it did exist. So like I said, the simple one here for most of us would just be go independent existence. Objective existence. If things actually did exist objectively, what would they look like?
Sue wants to know what page you're on.
What do you mean, what page I'm on?
What page with Geshe Tegchok?
156.
Okay, so then Anne's got a question then, instead of about self, about phenomena. So instance, with the concept of climate change, where does that sit in the analysis? It's happening because it's taking place, scientific studies prove it, but if it doesn't exist, are we denying that it's happening?
Yes, if we said it doesn't exist, we'd be denying it's happening, and that would mean we've sunk into the extreme of nihilism, where we are denying something that actually does exist. So that's an extreme. We've slipped off there. But if we said climate change does exist, the question is, how does it exist? That's the real thing here. We're looking at how things exist. So we go, oh, well, they exist dependent upon people, change, a whole lot of different things. Right? That's how it actually exists. Therefore, we can influence it. But if when you first say it, climate change, we start talking about it, and somebody just goes, no, it doesn't exist, or they go too far and think, yeah, it exists and there's nothing we can do about it. It's just a thing, a thing that objectively exists that's affecting us somehow. But dependent arising goes, if it exists, it depends upon causes and conditions and its parts and so forth.
And so then, Eddie, so because it depends on causes and conditions, that's actually where our hope lies, because then it can change.
Yeah, and because it depends on causes and conditions, it doesn't have an objective existence. It does not have an existence independent of us. That's what it doesn't have. It does not have intrinsic existence.
So Michael's saying, so does that mean climate change exists because there are a lot of minds proving that it does, that it can be measured?
Well, yes, that plays part of it, yeah. It also exists because, you know, we've actually designated, haven't we? We've called it climate change. And right. Why have we called it that? You know, it's not because climate's not changing, it's because climate is changing. So it's a valid basis to say there's a thing that's called climate change. And then we might ask, well, how are these changes coming about? And we could say, well, the seas are heating up. We say, well, how come the seas are heating up? You know, well, we're burning more fossil fuels. Why are we doing that? Da, 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 da. We find lots of dependencies that make up a whole.
So then with that thing of a lot of minds proving that it does exist, so say for a fish heating up in the ocean, yeah. It's not climate change that exists, it's just change of, you know,
environment.
Yeah. So a fish would call it something different, but it's the experience of a fish.
Is different too. You know, so it's dependent because the experience of the fish is dependent upon the fish, the body of the fish, the mind of the fish, and so forth. So that experience would be different than our one.
So then Michael's saying then we've linked it to a very big dependency, a chain, like a chain reaction,
labeled
climate change, and we can follow the chain back to all the various causes.
Well, to the best of our ability.
Yep. And, I mean, there was, you know, a couple of decades ago before we called it climate change. I mean, I think it was called global warming for a moment. And before that, it was just no one even knew what was happening.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, so when we do this, it's much, we can focus outside and look at chairs and the weather and all that sort of thing, right? But knowing about that doesn't actually put an end to our own suffering. You know, so we've got to look at, you know, so when climate change takes place and we find ourselves suffering, like why? You know, so the one thing we can say, well, it's dependent. Right? I mean, you could say, because the climate is changing, it's having an effect on the way I'm thinking about the climate. And the way I'm thinking about it is producing agitation and anxiety within me. Yeah. So then we can come and look at, well, what is anxiety and agitation? How do they actually exist? And what's it affecting? We could say, well, my mind. And we go, okay, so now we have a thing called a mind. The mind is a phenomenon, must also exist dependently. And so it's changeable and so forth. So we can see here that it could lead us to a discovery of what's actually causing us suffering and then to abandon that. Now, what the Buddhists are saying is the major cause that brings about the suffering is to take all these things called anxiety, fear, climate, and so forth, and think that they're sort of independent of you. They are affecting you, but from an independent stance, without realizing that actually, this is all taking place because of the dependencies. And whatever exists dependently lacks or is empty of inherent existence. So when we grasp, when our mind grabs the objects as if they inherently existed, then very quickly it follows that they do inherently exist. The mind will believe it. So here's a slide here showing the different levels of how this wrong consciousness called ignorance actually works. So we can see down the bottom here, this is the most simplest way going up to the most difficult. So there's a school called the Great Exposition School, which says that when we look out at the phenomena in the world, things don't appear to be changing. They appear to be singular and independent, not dependent upon us at all. So this is how we come into the world. And for most of our growing up, this is how it's been presented to us. So it looks like things are staying the same for a while. In fact, nothing stays the same for a while. there isn't anything that stays the same for a while. So there's a falsity right there. Now, not only within that, but our sense of self as persons appear to us to be self-sufficient, substantially existent. So we're real. And being real, then we own things and we control things. But once again, if you look for this real self as the controller, the owner, we don't find anybody like that. There's no such self like that at all. No person exists like that. So, you know, in these two bottom schools, that's like having a look at there's a world out beyond us, independent of us, and we're finding out as much as we possibly can about it. Well, these two schools go, they believe in all that. Come to mind only, they go, you look for a world out there like that, you won't ever find one. There's no such world that exists like that. So the only thing you can really rely upon is what your mind is doing. The mind is the creator of the world. What we call the world is not happening beyond the mind, it's happening because of the mind. So then you have these funny sort of things. Now I'm at the mercy of things randomly happening to me, and things are exactly how I see them and in no other way. You've got these two big swings. We have another school that goes, these guys have gone too far also. So we've got these guys that are really, the two bottom schools are like, what do you call it? Realists. The mind only is like a mentalist. So you've got the two different things, forms and not forms. These middleway schools say, no, it must be a bit of both. So the autonomists go, the things actually coming from their own sides, meaning that, you know, what I'm looking at exists like that. There are people over there. There are trees over there, all these sort of things. However, it's they are over there, but they are depending upon my own mind.
So, Eddie, this is quite interesting in terms of there is a bit of a parallel with the development of our Western scientific
tradition. Sure, that's right.
And, you know, the things out there for many, many, many years, you know, Newtonian physics, and then mind only comes along, you know, Schrodinger and all the quantum physics, and now it's suddenly.
Yeah, that's right. Now we're up here on the consequence level. So, you know, all of these, in the simple terms of what ignorance believes, things aren't actually like that. But because you believe it, we've got this thing called like, if we think there's some part of the object coming from its own side, then we have this belief in inherent existence. So we have to, you know, like I said, see if it's true. We find there is nothing at all coming from the side of the object. We destroy the idea of inherent existence. Now, like I said before, the great danger with this is that, you know, when we destroy inherent existence, it seems to us that everything is destroyed. Existence itself is destroyed.
And is that just because we're new to it, that we're a bit extreme?
Yeah, that's the major thing. That's why it's better to come at it from dependent arising first, so you get it really, you know, quite clear in your mind. Now, that's impossible. If it exists, it does so dependently. But, you know, let's go on. So verse 9 introduced us to the importance of understanding the correct view, and verse 10 was the correct view. Now, the correct view, one way of saying it or explaining it to oneself is that emptiness and dependent arising are take place simultaneously. Whatever arises is empty. Whatever appears is empty. That's the union of this. That's it. So I would suggest what you can do is just turn, look at anything, any part of your body or yourself or any object of your senses, taste, whatever. You'll see that's what you call like there's an appearance taking place, right? And the actual appearance you find most like is one to the mind. Now, if you have an appearance to your mind, the thing is it has arisen dependently. If it's dependent, if anything is dependent, it lacks or is without or is empty of true existence. So there we have the union of these two things, appearing yet empty. Empty of what? Intrinsic existence, objective truth, all those sort of things. Empty of that. Not nothing whatsoever. Whatever appears is existing dependent upon something else. So if you deal with your mind, well, it's obviously dependent upon your mind. So, you know, that's right there. And this is the one that I've often come to. It's like, you know, when you think it through, and I must have had something really good happen to me in past lives. But I just went through this thing, and just, you know, the atomic bomb just goes off, and goes, my God, whatever exists does so depend upon your mind. There's no way you can get away from it. But then it's like, okay, so I can only get at anything through the mind. So it's, you know, the question is, what are you creating with your mind then? Because whatever you create with your mind is going to have an effect on you. And you know, you look at that and you go, man, there's the thing about karma. It's not out. Karma's your business, my business. You know, the mind being affected by causes and conditions, habitual thought patterns. It's all come from back here, from the side of the mind, not from the objects that the mind engages with, you know, what you see and touch and hear and stuff. It's really back here. But then what's interesting is that if you look like back here at the mind itself to see if those things are there, they're not. They're not there. They're just appearances. They arise, they're appearances, but they're not there, just like the other person isn't over there either. So it's like things existing but empty at the very same time. That's how they exist. So a way to sort of, like I said once again, to slowly get yourself into this is to start off where it's very simple. So we have what they call objects of negation, things that don't exist but appear to exist. So those things that appear to exist, we have to sort of become familiar with that appearance. Then we investigate the appearance. Now when we see that it's not actually there, then the mind that grasps at them to be there will drop. There's nothing to hold there. It's not there.
So, Eddie, there's kind of like a process that we can go through as beginners where
yeah.
Start with dependent arising. We come to a conclusion of emptiness, and then we remember that they're simultaneous. It's not an either-or proposition because our mind grasps at it's got to be this or it's got to be that, but the simultaneous thing really seems to be the key.
Yeah, and this is what what's her name? Who was that great Dhamma? Kadrala, when she came here. You remember she asked the class and somebody answered and it was like that was half the answer. It was like, no, you have to go to emptiness and then come back out as dependent arising.
Okay.
So just getting emptiness, that's not it. What you got to get is whatever is empty exists dependently. And whatever exists dependently is empty. So, you know, I would suggest that for people who just get on the empty and just sort of focus on that, it's because they just get into this meditation, see that the phenomena lack inherent existence, and just stop it right there. You know, they rest on that, what they call, you know, space-like emptiness. But then when they come back out in the world, you know, it's like you mentioned an hour, take the understanding and use what they call illusion-like emptiness. You know, the things are appearing because they're empty. Not because they don't exist.
And so that's then our safeguard from just becoming like a nihilistic asshole.
Yeah, that's right. Because that's what happens. Eh? You often find people who study emptiness, well, as all people, but people, especially from Western character, who study emptiness, they can become even tighter, especially in their views. And it's like they sort of negate conventional appearances, conventional existence. I see this a lot on the Facebook, the different Dharma groups I belong to, and you go like, oh, yeah, okay. Another guy just suggesting just go to emptiness. You know? That's the big saviour. Anyway, so when we come to these objects of negation, we start off simple. So the object of negated, to be negated here, is the idea or the misconception that a person is permanent, unitary, and independent from its causes. So how do we know a person is not permanent? You know, and we have to do that, you have to go, what does the word permanent mean? You know, so we go, okay, is a person permanent? You'd go, no, they're impermanent, subject to change because they arise through causes and conditions. That's true. But then it's like, don't you often think that people are permanent? Don't you actually behave as if they are, that they are not changeable? That they actually are the way they appear to you? Don't we do that with people, events, and with ourselves? You know, we say, well, you haven't changed at all. You go, yep, I'm the same person. There's grasping at permanence, not changeable. Unitary is interesting. So here, unitary means without parts, meaning singular. So we talk about ourselves as a person, I, that's a singular, isn't it? It's one thing, an I, one person, me. Thing is, are you, are you a singular person?
Mm-hmm.
You go, well, no, I'm a woman, I'm a human, I'm a school teacher, I'm this, I'm that, and da, da, and you go, oh my God, you're not one single thing, you're all these things. So you're not singular. Yet you often appear to yourself to be singular, and anyone talks about you, they'll be talking about you as a singular. Independent from its causes. So like what are the causes that brought you about? Well, the causes that support your existence. So now I was thinking about this the other night, thinking, you know, when you look at causes, another word for that is a condition. You know, the causes that support your existence are so many. You know, you just run out of countable causes. So one of the simple ones I thought of was like, if you looked at space, like if you didn't have space, you wouldn't exist. You couldn't exist. Without air, we wouldn't exist, the air within space. You know? Without your mother's 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 mother's, you wouldn't exist. Without blood, not even your blood, but the blood that every human being has, you wouldn't exist. Water, there's just so many of them. So you can look at physical causes, you can look at mental causes. So you don't exist independent of them, you exist dependent upon them. So that's, you know, that's how you sort of start, where it's simple. And then you come to this one here, graspingly, I is self-sufficient and substantially existent. So this is here where we talk about ourselves as persons who have an I. You know, like we talk about, I'm going to go shopping, I did this and I did that. Right? So it's like that I that you're talking about, if it's threatened or if something great happens to it, it really feels like more than just a name put on the body and mind. It seems to have its own entityness. It exists sufficient unto itself. If you ask, like, where is it? You go, well, it's in me. It's in my body, in my mind. It feels like it's there.
So, Eddie, this is like one delusion leads to the next one in a way, doesn't it?
Yeah, because that's right.
That
yeah.
First one, being independent from its causes, we just see in our society all the time culture of entitlement, like, you know, we're a self-made man or a self-made woman when that's impossible.
Yeah. And not only that, you know, when you look back at what we're talking about with climate change, we're not independent of our climate, yet we are behaving as if we are. You know, so there's often all these warnings, isn't there? We better look at this, could be the end of the human race. Well, if we were not dependent upon the climate, we wouldn't be. But we are. You know, we need fresh water, we need clean water, we need good air to breathe, we need food to eat, all those sort of things. So we're not independent, but we're dependent. So you know, so we can see ourselves, even if we do this, like I said, using your mind and being logical and clear in that, all well and good. But then you look at, do you behave in this way that you've discovered the truth? And you go, nah, I actually behave as if I was permanent, if I was a singular entity, and if I were independent of the causes and conditions that keep me alive. So there's a big disconnect here between the way we are and the way we appear to be and act from that appearance. Big disconnect, and it's the same sort of thing here. You know, I mean, grasping the I means believing that we ourselves are, you know, sufficient unto ourselves. Another way, like being independent, but like being independent of the world, independent of your own body and mind. And substantial existence sort of means, you know, like a substance of some sort, something like real that you can really put your hand on, like you can put your hand on your arm. You know? Is that we scream out when somebody's about to hurt us, don't hurt me. Right? We're not saying don't hurt my body, don't mess my mind. We're talking about me you're hurting. This is a me that's substantially existent. A real thing, a real I that's going to be hurt. Right? The owner of the body and mind that will now be hurt. So we look. We see there is no I that exists like that. So what I've found really useful here is to take this idea, what it really, to get, you know, like shorthand. If the I was self-sufficient and substantially existent, it's like the owner or the possessor. It's within the body and mind controlling it. Whereas this next one, grasping the I as inherently existent, is the I and mind are the I. You know, so it's like they are the person. So, you know, it's just like simple first. No, you're not. You are impermanent. You are not singular. You're self is plural. And you are dependent upon all the causes and conditions that produce you and keep you alive. But then it will seem that this I is existing like truly within the body, mind, and controlling it. And then other times it won't be. It'll seem like, you know, like your whole body and mind is you. And none of those things are true. So that just, you know, like I said, that just tells us what's not true. Now the next thing, of course, we'll go like, so, like, you know, well, what's true? And you go, well, you're just the name put on it all. And it works. So, like this thing of, you know, at some point in time, suddenly they cease to alternate. So what suddenly ceases to alternate? The understanding that you're empty of intrinsic existence and that you dependently exist. And just by seeing that interdependence is unfailing, a certainty that destroys all misapprehensions come about. So the misapprehensions, of course, are to do with the interdependent being empty. This is, at that time, your analysis of you is complete.
Eddie, so there is a temptation then when we're doing this analysis to slide over to another extreme, which Michael's brought up, which is to say that we're all one.
Isn't that funny? We, which is plural, are singular. Well, we've already found we're not singular, remember? We're not singular and we're not plural. But we are imputed to the plural and imputed to the singular. But we are not singular. See, this is the thing, I mean, how inherent existence gets you. It makes the thing that you're talking about and you one and the same. That's inherent existence right there. But like I say, you investigate the one to find you. You, no such thing.
Brilliant. Michael says, snap.
So it's, yeah, like I said, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you can see here how your language creates also, and how you believe the creation of your language.
And so that's like a dependent arising existing in name only right there, isn't it?
Yeah, believing that's right.
How we frame things is then how we experience things.
So I better move on. So look, there's a thing called the King of Reason. So it's a wonderful thing to always keep in mind, and especially the example. So here's the best reason you can use. Take the person, take myself. I am empty of inherent existence. Well, Eddie, why are you empty of inherent existence? Because I dependently exist. So dependent and inherent are contradictory. So finding you're empty of inherent existence means, because you do exist, you do so dependently. Here's the next part I like. For example, like a mirage. So mirages appear. When they appear, it looks like there is water and trees over there. When you go over to have a look, there are no water, there's no water, there's no trees. In fact, the mirage disappears altogether. You don't see a mirage, it's gone. Same thing with a person. There's appearance of a person. The person appears to be like in there somehow, over there. You go to have a look, you don't, they're not there. So the trees and the water are not there as trees and water.
So this is the subtlety, isn't it, Eddie, that a mirage is actually there.
That's right. A mirage exists, that's for sure.
Because we believe it exists in the way it appears.
Yes, that's the mistake.
Then we get into huge suffering because
yeah, that's right.
Then we just like follow it and we're continuously thirsty.
Yeah.
But
it's the same here. We continually follow the desires of a self that appears to truly exist but doesn't. Then its desires cannot be met. You can never fulfill the desires of something that doesn't exist. Doesn't stop us trying though, does it?
No. It explains a lot. And I mean, because you'd be tempted to think, oh God, I'm such an idiot for not getting this. But it is it's really counterintuitive, because you see something, of course you assume it exists the way it appears.
That's right. That's right. That's what the mind naturally does.
Yeah. And like a little kitty would see, you know, a toddler in the desert would see the mirage and run for it. But so would a grown up.
Yeah, that's right. So we've got, what have we got? We identified the view. No, we looked at how important it was to have a view. Then I actually identified the view. Then the next verse looked at an incomplete analysis. Then there was the complete analysis. And now there's this unique understanding that Lama Tsongkhapa presented. So this was, like I said, unique to Lama Tsongkhapa. And it shows you the middle way in a slightly in a different way, in a unique way than what was normally explained. So here he says, furthermore, appearances clear away the extreme of existence, and emptiness clears away the extreme of non-existence. When you understand how emptiness shows itself as cause and result, you will never be enthralled by extreme views. So the first line, appearance is clearing away the extreme of existence. What is the extreme of existence in this case, folks?
I'm just giving everyone a chance to write in, but the extreme of existence, inherent existence?
That's right, Miffy. So here we have, so the first one is, the extreme of inherent existence. That is an extreme because nothing exists inherently. Yeah? So what clears that away? He says, well, the appearances themselves. Once you see an appearance, you will know it arises dependently. It exists dependently on cause and conditions, its parts, a name, a mind. Yeah? So this will clear away the extreme of grasping to truly exist. And he says that emptiness clears away the extreme of non-existence. So like an extreme of non-existence is to take something that does exist and to say that it does not exist. That's the extreme. Mm. Yeah. Now, how does emptiness clear away that? He says, because the understanding of emptiness is dependent arising. Anything that's empty and exists does so dependently. So it already exists dependently. So it can't not exist.
So that's very nice.
Yeah, well, I think it's a tremendous thing for practical application every day.
Also, Anthea has brought up something that's also really lovely. She just said, oh, poor humans, we really torture ourselves.
Yeah, this is right, Anthea. And this is why, you know, one of the foundation of Buddhism is compassion. Yeah, poor humans, poor every being.
So this is kind of the result, the emotional result that we get from understanding emptiness would then be more empathy, more care for others, a real just like, oh my gosh, the tragedy of existence, rather than say just flatlining.
That's right. And, you know, a real sense of altruism comes in. It's as if everybody... once you get your head around this, you'll know, oh my God, I can see. And everybody else has the potential to, but they don't. They can't yet. But they could if you help them. You know, because it's not going to change depending upon your senses. It changes in dependence upon how you think. Because every appearance is enhancing inherent existence. Things are existing in the way they're appearing. So you can't get it just through using your senses. You have to use your mind. You have to sort of take the appearances and examine them. And who does that? Very, very few people.
Yeah, we just don't have time.
That's right. That's right. We're absorbed in the appearances of the world. That's exactly right. Okay, folks, we better move on. So here's a simple meditation you can do for yourself. Like I'd say, who's on your seat? And you should say, well, me, I am. And I'd say, are the aggregates on the seat? Meaning, is your body on the seat? You have to say, well, yes, it is. Is your mind also on the seat? Well, you might go, oh, I don't know. But your body is your mind. Is, right? So, yep, aggregates are on the seat, and so am I. Are you the same as the aggregates? Your answer should be no, but you might say yes straight away. If you say yes, that means there are three of you on the seat. There's you, your body, and your mind. You, body, mind. Again, it's going to be three of you on the seat if you are the same as the aggregates. Or there's only one. Because, you know, you are one. You are singular. So then the body's on the seat, but there's no mind on the seat. Then there's a corpse on the seat. Yeah, oh, no, that's not right. If I'm the mind, well, then how come the body's on the seat? Because the body's not the mind. So there's two or three or more on the seat, you know. So you go, no, that's not the case. That's definitely not. I'm not the same as the aggregates. So, like, well, why not? So because I is a name imputed to the aggregates. That's why I'm not the aggregates. I've just got the name, Eddie. It's been put, you know, I got born with this body in mind. My mum said, call him Eddie. So that's what I'm called. So I, Eddie, is imputed to the aggregates. It's a name put on it. That's why I'm not the same as the aggregates. There you go. Yep. Okay. So now throw your body from the seat. Yeah, you can do that. What's on the seat? You're going to say, well, nothing is on the seat. There's nothing on the seat. You go, that means you don't truly exist. Because if you did, you would be on the seat. No, because you're not the same, are you? You're not the same as the aggregates. No, no, no.
Michael says, now Eddie is torturing us. We've been tied to the seat.
So, yeah, you know, I remember when Kensa Rinpoche did this, I just marveled at it. It was just like, wow, that is so straight to the point and got it. You know, but like I said, it's so simple. It's just six things you got to say. Am I on the seat? Who's on the seat? I am. Aggregates there too? You go, yep. Are you the same as that? You have to, you know, like I said, it's either yes or no. When you have correctly understood the essentials of these three principal paths, child, that's us, beginners, seek seclusion and strengthen your effort to swiftly accomplish your future well-being. So in other words, he's really asking us to improve our understanding of what we've learned. So it's not enough just to like listen to it once or twice or to read books and understand it. We have to keep listening, keep analyzing, keep talking to others about it, so we reflect upon an offering and then become familiar with it. And I remember a thing that Milarepa said. He said, look, I've never been to a monastic college. I don't have any books. My teacher was nature itself. So nature is empty of inherent existence. It exists dependent upon causes and conditions. We're the same. Nature has parts. Therefore, it's empty of inherent existence. We have parts. We're empty too. That nature, that thing called nature, if I don't put the label on it, is it nature? If I don't call it nature, is it nature? You'd have to say no. Until I put the name on it, but as soon as I put the name on it, it's nature. Until I do, it's not. Is there something appearing in front of me or to my mind that I could call nature? You go, yes, there is. So it's, you know, like, what, how come it's all appearing to my mind? Well, you've got some eyes, you know, you've got a brain, you've got this body for a human being. Therefore, this appearance can arise to mind. But if that wasn't there, if the thing that we call nature was not there, would it appear to your mind? You go, no. That's all dependent. If it's dependent, it's empty. So So once you know this, you know, really, you have to start being very, very careful in how you act. How you act will affect you, for sure. That's a certainty. It can also affect your environment. It can affect all the people you are in touch with, because everything is dependently related. It's related. This means we are the creators of our own experience. And these are two other things following. No? We are in complete control of our future reality. Will it be one of suffering? If it is, we are creating it. We have created it. We are engaging in the reality in a mistaken way. That's why we're suffering. If I didn't do that, is enlightenment, this thing called enlightenment possible? Yeah, yep. Just wake up to your own reality. Yeah. So I just read a little thing from what the Dalai Lama said. He says, reflection on causal dependence, that's the first level, clears away wrong views, such as believing our suffering can arise without causes, or that our suffering is due to an external creator, or that our suffering is due to a permanent cause. Identifying that ignorance and what they call formative action, also called karma, produce future lives, it eliminates the wrong view that everything stops at death. We also realize that our actions have an ethical dimension and influence our experiences. We also understand that all the causes of suffering exist within us. That's this wonderful thing too. The causes of our suffering are not out there. It's not somebody else doing it. It's not the weather. It's not climate change. It's not something external to us. It's within us. So, you know, like the word climate change, it came from us. It came. We used the language. We used our perception. We saw changes. We named it. And so it's not independent of us. It's depend upon us. So therefore, our relief from suffering can also be accomplished within ourselves. Anyway, this is the great benefit of dependent arising, of understanding dependent arising. And, you know, like when I was a kid, like at 18, I drew the wrong conclusion. It took more than 22 years to walk into a Dharma center, and then Geshe just said something so much like this, I nearly leapt off the chair. And I was like, that's it, it's dependent. If it's not independent and it's not, you know, completely separate, it must be dependent. So that's wonderful knowledge, this. So in summary, look, we've been looking at the advanced level of practitioner. We started by looking at the perfection of concentration and wisdom. And the rest of the time was spent on these nine verses, really talking about the view and an encouragement to become familiar with it. So this finishes off our 14 verses of the three principal aspects. And next week, we're going to be looking at the brief the history of the teachings of Buddha and Buddhism in Australia, Buddhism all over the world, in fact, and how it relates to our centre in particular. In the meantime, have a look at this meditation on emptiness that you have up there and review these three principles. This was taken from an examination given by Khinsu Rinpoche, Geshe Tashi Sering. Have a look at that. It really gives you a good in-depth overview and insight into the three principal aspects. Now, over time, try to memorize these verses. It's like having something on hand always to challenge the view of the grasping at inherent existence and to bring about a renunciation, a lessening of the causes of suffering, grasping at those two. So we've come to the end of our class. So I just want to dedicate for all of you, wonderful students engaged in trying to understand the relationship between dependent arising and emptiness, and hopefully concluding that this is really the deepest source of our suffering. All of our suffering is coming from this wrong view that things intrinsically exist when in fact they exist dependently. However, as it's a wrong view and just a mistake, we can correct it. And by doing so, bring about our own welfare and acknowledge that others just don't know about this. So we need to help them understand that things do not exist intrinsically, but do dependently. And therefore, they can actually overcome all of their suffering. So I dedicate that that happens, that we do that. And that we, by doing it, repay the kindness of our teachers and all other sentient beings. So thank you, everyone, and have a good week. And do your best not to cling so tightly to appearances. So thanks.